Mr. Barney Frank, it's so great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Before we get into the music, can you talk to me just a little bit about what inspired you to get into politics? Because you had a very long career from assistant to the mayor of Boston to 16 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives.
A sense that there was a good deal of unfairness in the society and an interest in changing it. There were two sets of issues that I got involved with. I was unusually interested in politics. I was fairly young. One was race. People learned recently about Emmett Till. He was a 14-year-old black kid from Chicago who was brutally murdered in Mississippi in 1954. I was 14 in 1954. I remember reading about that. And I was just outraged, not simply that he had been brutally murdered with law enforcement in Mississippi joining in the murder, much less trying to solve it, but also by the fact that the federal government, because of Southern obstructionism, couldn't do anything about it. Racial injustice has always seemed to me to be the single biggest problem America faces. And then I was also in my teens when former Senator, the late Senator Joseph McCarthy, was on his rampage destroying people's civil liberties. And in both cases, I thought, this is unfair and I want to fight it. I also realized, look, you know what you're good at and what you're not. Every kid, I suppose, or most kids think about being an athlete. I enjoyed playing various sports, but my talents never rose to the level where I could do it as an occupation. I was always good at talking. I was good at debating. I had a good sense of humor. So I put the two together, and it seemed like going into politics was a good way to do it. There was a problem, though, because I realized in 1953, when I was 13, that I'm gay. And in 1953, you had this situation where to be successful in politics, you had to be very popular. But being gay, we didn't use the word then, it was homosexual, in the polite term, you were very unpopular. So I began to think during my teenage years into my early 20s that I would try to find a way to be active in politics without ever running for office, because the notion that someone who was gay, homosexual, could get elected, even if you tried to hide it, you just would not be able to do the things you needed, the smiling wife and happy children and et cetera. So I, putting all those together, I decided I would go be working for other politicians.
And that's when you were working for the mayor of Boston?
Well, that led to my going to work for him, yeah. That was the mode I thought I would be following.
Well, you certainly had a long career in the House of Representatives. What kept you going?
Oh, well, one, I enjoyed it because, frankly, I was good at it. I find, you know, you can't live with a gun to your own head holding it. People who persevere in doing things that are hard for them, I admire their courage, but not their wisdom. If you really don't like something, you're hard to be good at it. Again, there are things that I'm not very good at. I've been in a lifelong war with inanimate objects. I break things and I can't get to work. I'm fortunate to be married to a man who is extremely skillful in dealing with the physical world. And I am not good at mathematics. I have trouble translating from three dimensions to two, but I am very skilled with words, with language. I am very verbally proficient, particularly talking. I'm okay at writing. I write okay, maybe well, but it's harder. But I talk good. intellectually, I'm kind of quick. I found one thing that was a defect when I was a graduate student. I was going to write a PhD thesis and do my politics from the academy. That seemed like a good place to go. I had the model in the early 60s when I was in my early 20s of the John F. Kennedy administration, where a number of leading Harvard professors, John Kenneth Galbraith and Arthur Schlesinger and others, went back and forth between the academy and working for politicians. That seemed to me the ideal way to deal with being a gay man who wanted to do that sort of thing. But I soon learned that a characteristic of mine made it very hard to write a thesis. But I also learned when I somehow sort of opportunistically got a job working for the mayor of Boston, that very same characteristic made me useful in certain kind of political jobs. And I'm serious about this. People think I'm kidding. I have a short attention span. That's a very hard thing to do if you're trying to engage in serious scholarship. But if you are a legislator, if you are a general assistant with a broad range of responsibilities for an elected official, you need a short attention span. You don't have the luxury of spending as much as an hour and a half on most subjects. And some people are disconcerted by having to jump around. I'm not. I'm disconcerted by having a lot of time to think. So I kept going because I was good at it. And because the cause was there, I continue to believe that trying to make this a fairer world is very important. Since I started out with race and civil liberties, I pretty soon got into economics as well, and much of my work in the Congress was on economic issues. But in all three of those areas, I believe people should have the freedom to make their own personal choices. I think we need to continue to fight against various prejudices, because I added LGBT prejudice later on, but any black prejudice has always been a tougher problem to deal with, one that causes more social harm and harm to individuals. And clearly the economic situation has gotten less fair over the years. So I continue to think that I want to see those changed.
So you retired several years ago. What drew you to this role as narrator in this musical piece?
I was asked. I'm a public performer. Part of you asked why I stayed in politics. Obviously, I enjoy performing. A large part of politics is performing. In fact, when he got elected to Congress and I was already there, Sonny Bono and I bonded. Sonny was a Republican. He's a funny guy and he was nothing like the kind of vicious right-wingers that unfortunately now seem to control the Republican Party, although obviously not all Republicans are of that ilk. And he and I used to talk about the performance element in politics. I have a lot of time on my hands now, and this seemed like an interesting thing to do. It'd be kind of fun, a new skill. At my age, I'm not into learning very new things. What I guess I would say is that public performance has been part of my career, and this is a new branch of public performance. So that's why I thought it would be interesting.
Well, I was going to say, you had mentioned that you had written two books, and you must have delivered hundreds and hundreds of speeches in your career. Are there parallels between music and politics, do you think?
I'm not much of an expert on music, and I don't know. There is this parallel, though, between any performance and politics, and that is ultimately the decider of whether or not this works is with the audience. That doesn't mean you simply pander to some low common denominator, but whatever you're trying to get across, whether it is a public policy change, a philosophical viewpoint, a view of human nature in a novel, a conception that's embodied in a musical piece, your job is, if you're trying to really have an impact, to shape that in a way that will reach the audience. And that doesn't mean the audience is the ultimate judge of worth. The audience is, though, the ultimate judge of whether or not your work is going to have any effect. Now, there were people who say, look, I don't care about that. I'm just going to do what I think is right. I think they're very much in a minority. Whether you're an artist or a politician, you want to change the world in some way. So part of your job is to take your conception, your idea, your goal, and without sacrificing your integrity, think about, all right, how do I maximize the chance that this is going to have the impact I want on my audience? And that's the commonality.
And this piece in particular, Journey into Jazz, seems to foster dialogue, and it aims to move people.
Well, it's interesting for me. I didn't know much about this. Obviously, I did know about jazz, and I also am very familiar with the author of the story on which it's based, Nat Hentoff, who was a leading civil libertarian and writer the Old Village Voice. So I'd met Hentoff and agreed with him on a number of things, disagreed with him on some. But yeah, this is very much a kind of interactive piece in terms of the musicians relating to each other. And of course, I grew up in the 40s and 50s. Jazz was very much a part of the scene when I was growing up, maybe even more than it is today. But yeah, there's an element. It's a story that talks about people interacting and somebody learning.
It's a really engaging piece with the orchestra and the jazz band and the trumpet and the narrator and the dialogue between the instruments, and classical and jazz don't always mesh. So it's really fascinating. Are there any parts that resonate with you in particular?
I'm not going to pretend that I'm much of an expert in music. I'll tell you what resonates with me. And it's even as we have been talking, you and I, this memory that was sort of lingering becomes firm. One of my earliest memories is of a form of this, namely narrated music. And in particular, one of my favorite pieces when I was, I don't know, we're talking 70 years ago, a narration of Peter and the Wolf with the music and music for the wolf. And as we talk, I realize that's what I've sort of been vaguely recalling, and the interplay of the narration and of the music sending signals. Now, I'm not a very sophisticated musicologist, so obviously people listening to this who are far more attuned to music than I are going to get those cues. When I was a little boy, I knew what sinister meant and what happy meant in the Peter and the Wolf and Brave. And so, that clearly, as I say, just as we talk, I realize that's what brings back very happy memories to me.
It seems that both music and politics and political speech aim to get people to listen and foster listening.
Well, as I said, you've got to be pretty entirely solipsistic not to care about the audience. I mean, certainly it's true in politics that you're trying to get things done. Now, look, there have been people who say, I'm a politician and I'm going to say what I believe and I don't care whether it influences anybody or not. And frankly, I think those are not people who serve their values very well, because what's the point of having all these wonderful values if you don't get any of them implemented? You know, all you do is maybe feel morally superior, but an unrealized ideal never fed a hungry child or kept a river from being polluted or housed a family or cured an illness or did anything for people in need. Similarly with music, the purpose of music is to, I believe, entertain, educate, stimulate the audience. So in both of those cases, the audience is a central player in this.
Right. So do you have a perspective on the role of music and art in today's world?
No, I don't pretend to think. I'm enjoying this. I think it's fun. But it's not an area in which I have any expertise. Maybe I'm overreacting, but my interests, intellectual, political, are very verbal. Words. I'm deficient in understanding a lot of other things.
So what in your mind now is the most pressing issue we face as a society? Is it possible to...
As an American society, racial inequality is still an issue. It's diminished. But the most important one now subsumes racial inequality to a certain extent. It's economic inequality. That is important both in itself because of the immorality of the pain that's inflicted on people and of the not just of the very poor, but of working people who don't have adequate resources to live the kind of lives that they should be able to live in a country this rich. And it also has this negative political impact because the resentments that inequality generate unfortunately get channeled in the wrong place. And I wish you had some of the people who were suffering from economic unfairness would be more supportive of the policies I think in their interests. I understand why they've kind of lost faith in government and don't believe in that. But I'd say economic inequality, particularly the economic inequality and the continued inadequate incomes for people in this very rich country, that's our number one issue by far.
Do you have thoughts as to what ordinary people can do to make a difference?
Oh, of course. Vote for people who will be supportive of these policies. One of the worst things that we have seen is people who get angry and then they turn away from politics. There is nothing better than voting. Register, vote, and once you've registered and voted, lobby the people who you vote for. This notion that they don't care is just nonsense. I've been there for 40 years. I was a legislator. I promise you that every other legislator that I ever worked with, myself too, we cared. Maybe they wanted to make people think they didn't to do away with the pressure. But this is a judgment that's made by the federal government, and if people will get engaged, look, there are people who sat out the last election because they were mad at Hillary Clinton. I hope they learn now the consequences of that. So if you think that we have a society that is far less fair than it should be, that there's excessive inequality. There's always going to be inequality. To a certain extent, inequality is an important positive as a set of incentives. But if you think there is too much inequality in this society, that the increasing wealth has been unfairly distributed, then you will find in any place in America candidates for federal and state and city office who agree with you, and you ought to go out and try and get them elected. That's by far the most important thing you can do.
Thank you so much, Barney Frank.